here we go, boys. It is the Race Communique, Episode 3, I guess the March edition. The classics are up and running. I'm joined by Luke Durbridge and Tom Southam. Boys, welcome again. Here we go.
Thanks, mate. Thanks.
Good day, as they say, Mitch.
G'day.
Well, set up where you are. Durbo, where are you, mate?
I'm at the Leppelbed in Ghent. In Belgium. Mitch, you know this place very well. I worked out the other day that I would have spent more than a year of my life here.
Ooh.
I looked next door and there's a little baby that was born and now he's riding his bike. That's how long. So, I think he might be 30.
He signed for New Year's Eve for six years already.
He's 13 years old now. It's a bit of a family hotel. The people here are lovely. We're deep in the thick of the classics at the moment.
Southern, where are you, mate? Where have you just got back from?
I'm actually on my couch, which is a relief, to be honest with you. I have just got back from Coppi Bartoli, gnarly little stage race down in Emilia Romagna and Marca. Tough race. And you might want to ask Heppy what he did wrong to get sent there every year, because every year I turn up and he's there.
I thought,
and it never looks like he's having fun.
I thought Coppi Bartoli was a pretty good race. I thought it was like semi-okay, pretty easy to get a result.
It's a good race. It's just really flipping hard, mate. Really hard. And yeah.
Well, Heppy does the trade-off of I either do the Belgium Classics or I go to Coppi Bartoli. So he must not really like the Belgian Classics. And look, sometimes I can understand why. So, you know, you don't miss it. It doesn't matter where you go in bike racing. You can't get an easy race.
True that.
Well, there's something exciting that's going on out to do with racing, but outside of racing, the Race Communique is exclusively being brought to you by the Escape Collective. The Escape Collective was founded last year in March with the goal of being the best bike website on the internet. And most excitingly, right now, they've bought out Grid Bike. Grid Bike, it's sort of like Footy Grid or Grid Game or any kind of sporting game. I didn't realize it was so big. I only knew about, what's another one, Durbo?
Wordle.
What's that?
Have you played Wordle before? Sure.
Words, mate.
I've never heard of it.
Oh, come on.
I've never played it, to be fair.
We're going to play a Wordle group. We'll get a Race Communique Wordle group going and you guys will be obsessed.
Well, we've got Grid Bike that we can do. It is a grid where you have to have guesses on the grid. You have to select a rider. Each sort of angle of the grid, it's a grid of 9 squares where each grid has to correlate with the question asked. So it could be like Tour de France winner, stage winner of the Giro. And that sort of grid square has to mark up to those two. The way you get better at it is the more rare your selection is, the lower percentage score you get. So if you get 2%, or 1%, you're in the, you know, it's a rarity. Only 1% of the people playing, which is 10,000 people a day, only 1% of them have chosen that person. So if you get someone that's like 99%, everyone's choosing that. You know, if you choose Pog or, you know, Froomey, they're the easy ones. They've pretty much done all the stuff. So you've got to think outside the box. You've got to get the person to fit that spot. And it's quite fun. Once you get into it, you get involved and you sort of get sucked into it. There's a leaderboard. You can see where you rank in the world. Guys, Southam, have you played it?
I've played it a fair bit. I love it. I have to say, Durbo, I got you in the other day. Australian who had ridden Flanders in the 2010 era. So I snuck you in. But I think about 18% of people had you. So you're more popular than you might think.
Thank you.
But I would say on that, I saw it and I thought, oh, great, this is going to be straight up my street. I mean, I work in the sport. I know what most people have done. You know, every now and again, I can pull out Andre Amador, who's finished fourth in the Giro and has done loads of other stuff that people don't know. I'm like, okay, this is going to be a good one. The lowest score I've got so far is 22.6, I think, and it did not even get me in the top 100 of the results. I mean, either people are scouring PCS, because I try and do it clean, like I do the bread and water version where I have to work it out myself. Otherwise you're just going to look at pro cycling stats. They should have two leagues. They should have a clean one
and a
pro cycling stats one.
I
doping bucket.
I did a clean, but with a TUE, And just did only one of my...
I had to see what for back, but cortisone for your knee.
I did one TUE and I did top 10 in Lombardia, top 10 in Liège. I was like, oh, who could that be? And I already wasted one of my squares. I thought Formolo, but I was like, it's too risky. I didn't have an undo. You can do one undo a day. I'd already used my undo, free me, screw me in that. And then the one I chose, I was like, I just did a quick TUE and I had a quick look on pro cycling stats. I did Higuita, got 0.8% had got it. An nice. Absolute rare diamond in the rough.
Nice. That's a good call.
But only
you know the whole time I played it about 2 minutes ago. That was my first time I picked it up and I didn't even read how to play the game. I actually thought it was like a hypothetical for this season. I'm like, how does everyone know their right race program? I'm like, I'm just going to pick Pog because he's going to be, you know, top 10 in zero and he's going to do this and then Remco and then this. I'm like, this is just actually... stupid game because no one actually knows whose race program is doing what. And I was just like, and now I'm just listening to you guys. I'm going like, oh, no wonder I was like 450 points because I had no idea what was actually happening.
I'm glad you brought Pog up because I'm going to kick it off this week with a bit of racing stuff because there's been heaps and heaps of great racing this week, well, this month actually. And we can start right back at Strade Bianchi because I thought it'd be really good to go right back. I don't really want to rewind every month right back to the first race, but I think this month we really got to go right through because there's so much good stuff happened. And Pog. Pogacar, he takes Strade Bianchi out, which I thought was really interesting this year. They increased the distance, 215K, 4,000 meters of climbing. Apparently, he said he would attack at 80K to go. He said it to a journalist before the race on Santa Maria, and he did exactly that. And he just pretty much took the piss. I don't know, did you guys see the race? What's your opinion of that? Thoughts on that?
I mean, I saw it. I watched it. I saw the interview and stuff before. But I mean, I think it's a little bit, not like, It's amazing, but it's also the same spot where he went last year, right? I mean, that's the place where you have to go. And then sort of the extra distance last year, or not last year, whenever he won last time, it was 50K to go. And this time it was 80K to go. So the extra distance they added actually played no role. Mm-hmm. The factor that's so hard is like that sector's so hard and so important. And after it, you get to this point where you've got one guy in front riding the race how he wants to ride it. He's going along and he's taking his lines. And behind, you could see, you know, like Ben Healy was desperately trying to get alone as well, so he could do it himself. But he was being marked, and then other people were jumping, and then you just kind of...
Did they forget to mark Pog, did they? No one marked him.
Yeah. Yeah, they...
slipped under the radar.
But... Yeah.
I'll let him go. He's coming back.
Yeah. But then you just get this kind of scenario, don't you, where there's too many people behind who can't separate themselves. Because Pogacar's team separated him by going so fast for like, so I mean, amazing ride, but I don't think what I think is it basically made no difference to make a shorter race or a longer race, you know?
The race, sorry to cut in, Derbs, the race I feel is, and it started out as a classic, a classic sort of feel race. And I feel like, you know, in the beginning, Cancellara was winning it, and you know, these sort of Roubaix, Flandre and style riders. And there was that, especially when I wrote it, I even went and wrote it, you know, I can't even believe that now, looking at the race, that there was a period where it was like a crossover. You had some classic skies there and some climbers were dipping their toes in. It's essentially just another climbers race now. It's an Ardennes classic. It's a like a Liège style race now with a bit of dirt involved. I don't think it really lends itself to anyone who's riding the cobblestone classics anymore.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I don't think it necessarily needed to be extra long. Like, I think that was the sort of attractive point of Strade Bianchi, that it was sort of, it was still a climbing race, but a bit more of a Flemish classic, sort of that sort of stuff. And I think now, like, for example, if you do put a Wout van Aert and you put a Van der Poel into this, Mads Pedersen, like, if you do put these guys into Strade Bianchi now, with that extra 30K, that's just an extra 30K where Pogacar can just outclimb them over a period of time. Mm. And I think if you just have the less extra 30K, then you're going to get a bigger guy maybe towards the finish, you know? So that's right. It's just elevation, just eventually for a bigger guy, it's just too much to carry uphill. So yeah, it doesn't really, I don't think it's necessary. It was exactly like Tom said, it's exactly the point you should go. That's the point where the race blows up. And then after that, it's a bit of a death march to the finish. So it really was at the end of the day, I turned it off actually. I'm sorry to Pog, but it was just like, oh, perfect. Yeah. What's, you know, like, it's just like, done now, it's 80K to go. It's sort of like, this is watching their time trial now. So yeah, like, and it was unfortunate because everyone behind is like, also what Tom was saying, like everyone just, well, if I can't get Pog, it doesn't matter even about Pog. It doesn't even matter about the victory. we're just not even going to work together to get the victory. We're just going to race ourselves to get on the podium, which is happening as we will speak more and more through Catalonia. It's about that podium. Nothing even, no one's even attempting to do the whole victory because it's unachievable at this moment.
I reckon there's almost like a shift where the podiums suddenly become more important.
So much.
Because, you know, years ago, if you didn't win, it was just forget it. You know, if you're second or third, it's kind of nice. Maybe you get some ham or something, but like it wasn't a big deal. But now it's like, that is like a real thing. When you've got these guys, you know, Remco's gone with 60Ks to go. Like, it was a big thing for Skuyans to be second there.
Massive.
You know?
Yeah, massive.
And that's becoming more and more in teams, I guess, not in their thinking. It's like, okay, well, let's aim for that now. Well, not aim for it, but like, let's take it once this guy's gone, let's fully go as hard as we can for a second or a third, which is a bit different.
And it's also signing. It's also, sorry, Mitch, it's also signings as well. Like, for example, if you're trying to, it could have easily been what Trek did at the moment, build their classics team. And obviously Mad Pedersen was he won yesterday. But if, say, for example, he did run second, they would be second in E3. They'd be second in Strada Bianchi. They'd be second in Harlbecker with Sturven. And then they might go on to be second or third in, you know, Flanders and Boer. And look, they might not have actually won a classic the whole time, but they've had a incredibly successful classics because they've been on the podium at every single one they raced for the Flemish period. So it worthwhile in terms of, you know, even signing these guys. Like Tom Skuyans, for example, is now like a very attractive rider for another team because if they go, look, yes, we can't afford to get Wout van Aert, but we can, you know, try and sign Tom Skuyans and we can try and sign, you know, Jasper Sturven or these guys that will get us podiums, which it all does come back to that point system as well. Like, you don't want to be spending 3 months away from the points tally, you know, where teams are like, let's not worry about the classics. We just need to keep, like Tom was playing last podcast with UAE, you need to keep the gap closer to Visma. So let's just keep chipping away at those points so we don't go completely cold turkey for a couple of months. And that's what's happening.
Speaking of Visma, I think it was really interesting you brought that up. I wasn't going to talk about that, but I think it's really interesting point to bring up is, you know, after we're sort of skipping through the races now, but, you know, you had San Remo there. Obviously, you got E3. Well, not obviously, but you had E3 on Friday. Also then, again, Wavelgem yesterday. The lack of presence, and I know there's been a bit of sickness and, you know, there has been some good performances from Van Aert, you know, who crashed in E3 on the Paardersberg, but then also another rider who I thought rode really well was Jorgensen, who stepped up. But actually that dominance of I heard the commentator say the Bumblebees, it hasn't been there in the races following the opening weekend. If you compare it to the opening weekend, you know, I'd even dare say, have they peaked too early? You know, we threw that out maybe in the last pod. Well, I maybe threw it out and said, you know, it's a long way to Flanders. That you said before, that everyone was competing for second. UAE got the second there and they were happy for second. Remember, we had that exact same conversation a month ago. Where are these guys now? What is your opinion on that? You know, with Flanders around the corner, Roubaix still, you know, 2 weeks away. What are we going to see these guys? How are they going to sort of come back to the fold again?
But for me personally, I saw Trek made an interesting tactic and didn't send their full A squad to opening weekend. And we discussed that. And they were, you know, Mads Pedersen wasn't there. A few of the other Kewell guys weren't there. They were training in Mallorca. And then they came in after Paris-Nice. And I think E3 is that, and Strada Bianchi, like, nothing to take away from Strada Bianchi, but half the peloton's in Paris-Nice. So you have half in Paris-Nice, you do the Strada Torino program. So when it comes to E3, it's the first time all of them meet. So I think Jumbo bossed opening weekend, but I would say they bossed opening weekend without the full field from Trek, from
B-grade.
You know, yeah, and also there's a lot of guys
victory.
Like, not a B-grade victory, but even UAE, you know, you've got guys like, you know, Jasper Philipsen in UAE, you've got some good lead out guys in Quickstep in UAE. So that whole thing is not, so E3 was literally like, this is every single
person
that is going to do the classics is here. And that's, and look, man, Trek dominated. They did a fantastic job. I mean, Van der Poel obviously is Van der Poel, but Van Aert was alone into Kotikia. Van der Poel was alone into Kotikia, and Trek had 5 guys, and that's huge. That's so hard to do, and that's so impressive.
On the flip side, I'd say that, I mean, how many times have we seen Van Aert be so good so early and then fail at Flanders and Roubaix? You know, so maybe he's going to come super good later on for those, for that, you know, that sort of 10-day period there. That I could see that happening, you know, with how much people train outside of racing now. There has to be, like, I think there's a big shift in not racing, being away from the races, and being prepared to maybe be a little bit behind the eight ball at E3 to be ready for Flanders and then Roubaix. I mean, I've spoken to you about it, Mitch, about how, like, the fatigue getting towards Roubaix at the end of how long you've been, you know, just away. So, because he's also doing the Giro, right? So it's a bit of a different shape year for Van Aert. But I could see him potentially coming back and changing people's opinion.
I think it's interesting when you said Durbo, one thing that stood out for me is the dominance of Trek as a team, who have almost taken the reins over from Visma Lisa Bike. Because, and that dominance is, it's great to see on TV, but to actually understand, I'd like you to sort of give me a bit of perspective on this, or give the listeners a bit of perspective on that, because Jayco were quite together as well in the race, but except you guys were on the back foot repairing. These guys were on the front foot as a team, getting together in these races. I'm talking about Gent Wevelgem now, getting together in these races. They were together in E3. They were as a team in Gent Wevelgem, and ultimately that opened the race up for them. Mads Pedersen, sorry. Ultimately, he has to still be a very good rider to finish it off, especially the way that he did in Gent Wevelgem. Having the confidence to lead that sprint out against Van der Poel was, for me, amazing to watch that. But for me, the amazing thing coming out of those two races was the way Trek rode as a team, as a unit, and just having the numbers there, the quality of their riders on the day.
Yeah, I would say that they've been building for quite some time, and even the way they were doing probably last year or the year before, they were, you know, not necessarily riding off the back of Quickstep or Lisa Bike. They were, you know, picking a side of the road. They were having the guys, and you know, they've got some really good guys. And I think with Trek, you have probably five guys that could be top 10 in these classics. And that's sort of like old days of Quickstep. There was sort of five guys that were, or could be top 10. And look, to have that many numbers in finals, that's sort of what you need to have. And I sort of was listening, and just from what I heard from Van der Poel, was like, I thought maybe Friday took the edge off Van der Poel for Gent Wevelgem, the big solo attack there. But even in the report, they sort of said that what Milan did attacking alone to make Van der Poel chase, he had to close a 30-second, 40-second gap by himself, which then took the edge off, and that also helped Mads. So, yeah, look, just having those guys there, like if you've got numbers, the numbers game is the key thing here. When you're alone, you do your own run-ins, you do your own sprints to corners, you do all these sort of things. So just having numbers create space, and yeah, it's cool to see like a team that's obviously been working really hard at it and come to fruition. And like I said, maybe this will be the only classic they win, but I'm sure they'll be on the podium in the others.
I've got to make mention of one rider who I thought rode amazingly well. 21-year-old Lawrence Pithay from New Zealand. Just the cool head on him, actually. Like he had the ability, but riding with those guys, just matching their ability, not being forced to roll through when Van der Poel was closing that gap, whether, I don't know, he gave him the elbow or not. I was so blown away by his ride, and I was sad that he couldn't crawl back over the last time over the Camelberg, because he deserved third, I think, at least third, maybe more, but he definitely deserved to go to the line with those guys because he rode amazingly. Durbo, give us a little insight to what you think about Pithay's ride, and actually just quickly about the day itself, because you were out there yesterday at Wevelgem.
Yeah, it was super impressive. And like from what I saw from, I guess he won Geelong's Classic. So he's obviously had some form from the start of the season. But even then, from opening weekend through to Paris-Nice, through to San Remo, I've done quite a bit of racing with him. And he's really, really good. The way he moves through the bunch, when it gets grippy, you know, he's there. He's not afraid to, you know, I think in opening weekend, he put himself on Van Aert's wheel when he went. Just all those little things are just, there's no care or no respect, but like there's no fear of like who these people are or what he's actually doing. He's just getting it done. So yeah, and he's a good guy. And so yeah, I really, really impressed by him. And I think maybe not a win in this period is going to be possible, but you know, I think we're not too far away seeing him on the podium in some of these classics. And with the squad with Kung and FDJ there, like, I think if Lawrence can get into the final, he's going to have someone like Kung, which is, to be honest, that's probably where Kung's let himself down. Not let himself down, but like not been able to get the result because he can't have that sprint. And because Lawrence can sprint, you know, you never know if there's two of them. Kung can pretty much close anything. So if he can put himself in a select group with Kung, they could definitely put, you know, that support around Lawrence to get on the podium. And then yesterday was a wild day, you know, 50K an hour gust through the Morden, sort of stuff of sends a fear up most people. So, yeah, it's a tricky one because it comes 70, you know, a 90K into the race of a 250K race. You sort of think, is it worth the investment? But you can pretty much set up your whole day. And I think we hit 72Ks an hour in the Morden. And that's, you know that road, it's flat as. So it's pretty scary. There's a few big crashes, things like that. But yeah, it all split up there. 56.
No way.
Mate, it's not a kids race, Mitch.
56.
We raced 56. Yeah, 56.11. Yeah.
I used to get shot. I was like, what do you got a 54 on? And everyone used to hang on me. 56 now. I'm talking, we're talking about the front chainering here.
54 standard, mate.
54 is standard. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
That was it. We come off the moor, a huge split. Two of our leaders missed it. So me and my teammate, Elmar, we committed to close it down because probably we had the most to gain if we got back in the race. And look, it was one of those things that I knew if I committed there, then my race would be over, which is unfortunate because I do like Ian Wevelgem, and you never know when you get to the climbs, it's sort of a race that I could potentially be in the final of. As a sort of bigger guy, I'm sort of going to be in the final of Ken Werber, I have been before, but it's more like needed to be done because if we got back to the front group, which we did, it gave Dylan and Michael Matthews time to actually get themselves into position before the Camelbird. Because if we had waited and the gap had blown out, probably only 10 guys would have ridden across on the Camelbird, and that might have been Matthews. But with Dylan there, he's always super motivated for this race, and he rode amazingly yesterday, and he would end up being ninth. So, yeah, I mean, for us, top 10, you know, it's nothing to, you know, pop the champagne over, but it's something that we've been working to try and get a good result and get Wevelgem. And if we can get the top 10, that's good in these classics. So it's good to go forward for the next couple of them now.
I'd say the top 12 is the important thing. Where Bissiger finished, it's just always the top, about the top 12 and get well.
I've been missing missing the pinkies up there. I saw you had a couple up there in Wevelgem, but not too many in the front in E3, Tom.
Betty old crashed.
No, we lost Alberto in an early crash at E3, and Owain Dool, who was actually doing really well. So we've got, I mean, it's you know, three programs on at the minute, and then every time you know your phone goes off, it's the medical channel, and there's somebody else has basically gone in a ditch. Yeah, yeah, it's a difficult time of year, and those races, they're so unforgiving on you know, if you lose your really good riders for that, and then you're left with other guys who have to go and fill in. You know, it's really challenging for a lot of guys. We've got a lot of young riders. And they've obviously got to learn what's going on. One question I had actually for you guys that came from that pithy thing was, do you think that it gets harder for a rider? So if you come in as a 20-year-old who knows nothing, right? And all of a sudden you pop up in your first sort of attempts and you're getting results. When you then have to think about it, does it get more complicated and harder because you know what you're doing, do you reckon, or not? Question.
I'll jump in. I would say in my own experience, some of my better results, if not best results, was when I was naive and I didn't really know what I was doing and just was trying to sort of test the waters per se. I don't know, let's just see how far I can go. And not knowing and just sort of writing up stuff and not having a ceiling on what I thought can and can't do. I'm a completely different rider to Lawrence Pithay in terms of he's probably exceeded my ability already in his first year or second year. But you know, there is an element to that, I think. Durbo, I don't know, like you still grow, you get more experience, but with that, I get the feeling you do limit yourself with an element of, oh, I know I can't do that, or I know a better way to do that, or whatever.
Yeah, I think I think it's two ways about it. Like, for example, for myself, like I was up here for a while before I actually started to get in the front of these races because I couldn't work it out. And I had an engine, but I couldn't work out a run in. It wasn't until probably 2017, 2016, I was started to actually be in the front of these races. So I think it's two ways about it, because for example, like Lawrence, like now he's up here, maybe the pressure's on next year, he gets support. And then there's that element of like, don't use too much energy now here, Lawrence, because you've got to save it for the final. Don't use too much energy, you've got to save it for the final. And next minute, all of a sudden, he's never reacting. He's never going. He's never, like, these races are not saving energy races. Like, you know, Mads Pedersen does max sprints into the Canaryberg, you know, 180K to go. It's just, that's just, you just got to do it. So, yeah, I don't know. I think sometimes it's better, but yeah, like, it is interesting. Like, I think there'll be a lull. Like, Lawrence Biffy probably will be this, and then there'll be a period of like, right, now, do I love these races? Because like Lawrence Biffy can go to Catalonia and also win stages because he can also climb. So there's this element of like, these are hard and they are generally bad weather and they are mentally one of the hardest races of the season. So it is up, kind of up to them, and they can go, I can do all these things. Now, where do I want to put my focus to? And not, I would say not many of those guys choose to then go on to do the classic stuff because, you know, it's probably not, it's not easier, but you know, Catalonia versus that. So it's just up to Lawrence. If he goes, fuck yeah, I love how hard these are. I love how filthy they are. Okay, next year I'm going to come up and do some recons and I'm going to, you know, do this and do that. Then maybe next year he won't be good, but he'll win one in 3 years' time. You know, like that's the sort of difference. Mm. Like Thijs Benoot was one of those guys. He was Flanders. I think he was top five in his first Flanders. Then he went quiet for a little while, you know? And then because he loves him and he's good and he keeps going and blah, 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 then it's not unheard of that Teach pops up and wins Kerner Russell's here or wins Strada Bianchi there or whatever, because he'd spent the time to get, you know, to work it out. And then he went on to win one. But yeah, it's just a choice that he was going to have to make.
Interesting.
I think a really good point. There's only one last thing I want to cover in racing, and very quickly, and we're not going to give it enough time, is Catalunya. You mentioned it, Durbo, but we've got to quickly mention the absolute total domination by Pog Pogacar. I'm talking about four stages, potentially five. Young Australian Nick Schultz took the first stage in front of Pog where he got second, but he won four other stages than that. But they weren't just all mountain stages. There were some stages that you say, like a guy like Lawrence Pithet could have won. He won the points, he won the mountains, he won the GC. It's setting up. This is sort of the GC game talk now coming out of the classics. It's not my area of expertise, but it's looking pretty good for Pog moving through the season so far.
I think he actually, like, I mean, from what I understand, like, Red was reading about, you know, he has a goal to win all of the, like, the seven sort of non-Grand Tour stage races as well. You know, I like the fact he's ticking off races all over the calendar without even looking at the bigger picture, right? So last year he won Flanders, this year he's won Catalunya, he's won Paris-Nice. Like, I kind of like the fact that he's got this idea that he wants to win like a huge, great, varied amount of races. I mean, I watched the first mountain stage where he won and I read the race reports. You know, basically everyone was freezing cold and he was just hammering along in a skin suit with no undervest. And it's just like, what? I mean, it's incredible.
Perfect, guys. Well, let's wrap it up there. Stevie Williams, post TDU, is showing some top form. I want to give him a quick little mention. Three top tens. So he's got the TDU sort of crux off his back, in my opinion.
All right, guys, Pella Chat. What I would like to, I guess, for the viewers out there, is sort of run through what I've seen over the last couple of years, a shift in terms of sports, like not sports nutrition, but the way we measure and calculate things throughout the day on race and at home, depends on how military you are. The what is happening now is that with our, obviously, power meters on the bike, we can measure our calorie expenditure. That's been around for a long time. And this big push for carbohydrates intake throughout the races is, you know, it is quite it's quite important. That seems to be the major fuel source. Back in the day, Mitch and I, Tom as well, we would, you know, probably go out in a black coffee and try and, you know, burn fat and try and get more efficient because we were only eating, you know, one bar an hour or 30 grams of carbs per hour. But now they're pushing in limits of up to, you know, 120s to 130s to 150s of carbohydrates per hour, which is insane. And that's something that, you know, is making everyone faster because people are not blowing. You know, we had that ability that guys would just generally fade as the race went on, because you run out of calories. But now, because you've got fuel on board. You know, these efforts that guys are making after 250k are only a couple of percent, you know, down from where they would do at the beginning of the race, which is pretty impressive.
So just to interrupt, are you still doing fat adaptation, or is that just completely gone now? It's just like fuel up from first ride in the season.
Yeah, it's maybe only within training. There's definitely nothing in racing. It's more or less once you are at race weight, then from then on, it's just keep that carb engine going. There's no real advice around any sort of fat adaptation that I have had. Yeah, like I said, maybe up at altitude, some of the climbers potentially might do a fasted ride here and there, but it's almost like it's planned and it's a big deal. You know what I mean? Like, we would have it like, okay, tomorrow you're going to start and you're going to have the first hour without carbs or first 2 hours without carbs, like saying it's going to be a hard thing. And you're like, well, come on, man, like that's nothing. But once you've moved the engine into carb engine, is actually quite tricky. Like having that little window where you're not eating is just like, whoa, I need it, you know?
So how are you guys, I guess, sorry, just to interrupt again, but how are you guys managing weight then? Because, you know, back in the day, I felt like you're always sort of trying to back end that massive intake from the classics, especially, you know, you're fueling up for the classics, you're fueling on the bike, you know, you may not get through a race or it may not be as hard as you thought, you know, because of puncture or whatever fault, you know, getting drops in my case. So how are you managing weight and not just turning into, you know, just big sumos?
Well, you'd be surprised, and I was probably pleasantly surprised when I started my carbohydrate intake just all the time and never really went into that fasted state. Or there's an element of, sure, your stomach is working harder, but the other one is that you're actually not under stress, so your body's not under stress. And when your body's not under stress, then it's in a nice homeostasis that it actually starts to lose weight and you get skinny and you get lean. And when everything's nice and like your body's not holding on to anything extra because it's fearing that this might be its last meal for a while. So when you have that constantly going through, the inflammation goes down. And like, there's obviously two sides to it. You know, like I'm not talking in a general nutritional sense, like the amount of food we eat, I wouldn't suggest that we would eat for a normal person because you will end up like a sumo. But yeah, I think there's an element of like, I've been eating carbs now, you know, consistently more over the years, and I've been as constant and skinny throughout the whole period than I ever have been, because I don't think my body's under any, you know, restriction phase. Anyway, so what I would just quickly want to cover was pretty much our program and how it goes, is that I would say a lot of teams are doing this. I don't know if somebody's ever been on this team. From what I've heard, it's pretty similar. So for a grand tour or a stage race, we would get a plan in the morning of what to eat on the bike in the race. So we'll have like the course overview. So you've got the little parkour at the bottom, and then you might have your mountain, your this, your that, your flat section, whatever. And it's got your bottle point. So there might be a bottle point, like a soigneur at kilometer 50, a kilometer 100, and a kilometer 150. And at each point, they have the certain bottle that you would need to have at that point in the race. So you might start with a small carb at 100, at 50. You might start with like a medium carb at 100, and you might start at, you know, a big carb at 150. And then you've got every hour throughout that, you know, overview of how much you need to eat. You might eat two gels and one bottle. And then it'd be like one bar, one gel, and a bottle. And then towards the end, if you know, going towards the final, you might have one caffeine gel, you know, a beetroot shot maybe, and a big carb. So pretty much we would have like exactly what I need to eat for the whole day. So that's done. So that, and then when we come in after the race, we have our power meter goes up. Uploads online, the nutritionist sees it. Then we get guidelines on what to eat after the race. So we have the pastas there, we have the scales, we weigh, she might say 250 grams of pasta. So we weigh the pasta, 250 grams, 100 grams of sauce, some protein shake, have that, you weigh. Next hour would be maybe another little snack if it's a long time till dinner. It's ridiculous. I know you laugh.
This is ridiculous. So wait, is this more or less than what you were used to having? Like, were you looking at it going, oh my gosh, I was way overeating, I used to pig out? Or are you like, oh my gosh, I can't even get all this in, I was under fueling? What's the perspective?
Well, if I start to think back to some of the meals that me and you used to eat for world championships, I think potentially we were overeating, but I also think it's hard to...
What about like on the bus, post-stage?
Oh, no, post-race is pretty common. That's pretty standard. Like, that's like, That's just a bowl of pasta and some protein. Like that's nothing out of the ordinary.
I was just
no, no,
because
no.
you have like almost like periodization basically. So you need to get this in now. This needs to be this, and you have like a it's all very prescribed. Which I mean, I personally would find mentally quite hard. Like that's a quite a big toll because I've been testing our team's app that we use for it just to see how it works. You know, like what sort of strain the riders are under. And I mean, going to a restaurant now is like. It's almost if you're doing that properly, it's almost off the table because you can't.
So outside of the race, they're on that app as well, of course, when they're training and stuff like that. Mm. When they're at home, you're on the full regime.
But periods, I think. Oh, a great anecdote actually from from this sort of thing. So I mean, I copied Bartley the other day. I don't know why, but at that race, I've never seen so many individual sets of scales with riders. So like every single rider coming to dinner. The first day we're in the same hotel as quite a lot of teams. And then from then on, we were just with one other team. And it was this like tiny, 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 small Italian team. I had to go and look this up after the fact that I think their first rider on GC was 38 minutes, right? And these guys are weighing their food to the point where like they've all got scales and they went over to have ice cream one day. And they basically went over to this like ice cream chef and he had them weigh out with their scales the ice cream.
Inside the hotel or actually at a gelati shop?
In the hotel, but the hotel had like an ice cream guy and you could just see this like, what am I doing? But hang on. Yeah. One more scoop. I'm just like, boys, come on. If you're wearing your ice cream, you've missed the point here.
Yeah. If people travel with them, mate, that's it. Like you just weigh everything. Like, I mean, we've got quite a good group here at the Classics where everyone gets it. They know how much they sort of need to eat. So everyone's doing a bit like, you know, we don't have too many scales and maybe because we're all the older boys here, we're all like, what are these guys doing? But the travel scales, travel food scales and the travel weight scales, like everyone has their, like when they travel, they have their scales, they weigh themselves. Like I was rooming with another young guy, I won't name names. They weighed themselves before the stage, just before they got on the bike, they weighed themselves post stage and they had their food scales and they were weighing like Haribos and stuff after the race, you know, how much lollies they could have.
Yeah, it's wild times.
This is next. Like I when I cracked a couple of years ago, it was already too much for me with whereabouts, everyone knowing, you know, where you are, then you got to have your power file up, then we had our WhatsApp group, then there was emails, and I just felt like then there was the sleep device. I'm like, oh, how much of my life do you want of me? And now this is the next step.
All of
it's
it.
Just like all of it. Exactly. you guys are nuts. I can't do
Give
it.
Us everything.
Give me your firstborn child.
He's already signed for UAE, Marlo.
Yeah, he's already signed. Yeah, 10 years on Marlo Docker. Anyway, that's it for me. I just wanted to say how it's changed, God. And look, it is just it is exhausting, and I tend to just do it on grand tours. But what I will say is that this is why the racing is so fast, and this is why every day it doesn't matter. Like in 21 days. You know, you are feeling able to push and to do well in these really deep in these grand tours because you have looked after every asset and it does make a difference.
So, fellas, Tom's tactics, or is that what we agreed on? Is that what we're calling it? Or lack of tactics? Because this week I want to focus on something I saw again. I think a lot of times people can prescribe after the fact things they think people have thought about or done, and where the tactics actually really happen isn't always so much on the road. And it's Platt took the yellow jersey at Paris-Nice, and that was like, it was a move that, correct me if I'm wrong, Durbo, because you're obviously there, he basically was told to just be in one corner in a good position, or first, I think, into a corner or across a climb. So Luke went, obviously, and he followed, I think, a Soudal guy, found himself in front. Butrago came across and he ended up taking the yellow jersey from, I think, UAE, who until that point had looked super, super dominant and really strong. They obviously won the team time trial ahead of you guys, wasn't it? Derby, were you second?
Yep.
I think you were, weren't you? I think you beat us. Yeah. Must have rained for us.
Yeah, it was definitely raining for you guys. Yeah, we had it all in the dry and tailwind.
But the thing for me, like, so that situation happened and he took the jersey and he was actually ended up doing a really nice race. But I think kind of what interests me is like the work that's been done to make, because he's a guy who struggled with small roads, struggled with racing in Europe and struggled with the whole picture early on in spring. And now at Paris-Nice, one of the most difficult races in the world where like the fight is really on all the time, he's popped up and done like a fantastic ride, which, you know, led to a great race for you guys. I mean, do you guys see that as much changed in the team with the way you're working? Because I think the team's working on like a really good level this year. You're getting results with Chris Harper. He's performing above where he's performed before. You know, the youngster I've had up against us in Copy Bartley was doing really well. Del Preto, I think it is. He was racing really nicely.
Yep.
So as much change in the team, you were right there at Paris-Nice. What was it like there and how did that all evolve?
Yeah, I think, well, I mean, in touch on the team aspect, I think that, yeah, we've made some really good signings this year. Obviously, Plappy coming over, which was a really big signing for us. But look, I don't think too much has changed. And Tom, you would know this, is when we have made some changes a few years back and we have been working to get to this point, and the nutrition has changed and, you know, chefs at every race and some more training camps and the equipment moving on to Giant has been an amazing change. And Marco Panotti, who's a tech support guy behind the scenes working on aerodynamics, which is why we were one of the dominant teams in Triple T's and we hadn't been back up there in a while. And look, our squad in Paris-Nice was strong, but on paper you would say, you know, they'll be around the mark. But to be second and to nearly get the win with that sort of squad is a lot of tech has gone into that and a lot of work. And so, yeah, I wouldn't say there's one thing going, oh my God, this is what we do better this year, because it takes so long for these things to have effect. And this is where it's hard with sponsors to try and keep believing that it's going to move in this way, you know, but we have got some really good things going, and then confidence builds confidence from the start. We didn't have a great Aussie summer, which was obviously not the plan, but from Middle East onwards, we've really started to gel and things are starting to come forward. And I was rooming with Lappy and this was amazing. Like, this was a really, I mean, he was sixth place on GC, which is really good, but nothing, you know, but to take the jersey the way he did, you know, he obviously struggled after that massive crash in Down Under, and like mentally it was pretty tricky to get him to move through the bunch. And there's a lot of work to be done. What I had never really spent too much time with Lappy, but he's got a Remco style engine. Like, this guy has a massive engine. It's incredible, actually, because the inefficiency that he rode through the bunch in Paris-Nice, we were really trying to get him into these points. But when it got hard, I think the other day on the Chipressa, he broke the record on Chipressa. He has the Strava now because he went in last wheel and he was
last wheel
over. Yeah. He was first over the top, not first over the top, but first over the flat section. So this guy has a massive engine and we're really excited to see where this can go. I know that stage in Paris-Nice was Heyman was the director and Plappy came back to give him his rain jacket. And I think Heyman had sort of had enough of him riding bad position all day. And he said, look, if you want to do anything in this bloody bike race, you get into that corner first wheel. And so Plappy's like, okay. So I don't know how inefficient he did it to get there, but he got himself there. And then he just, you know, he doesn't care. And it's great. I really love the way he races. It's like we spoke about Ben O'Connor last week. They sort of, these Aussie guys, they're just going after it. And Plappy just went for it and it was not planned. It was definitely not planned. We wanted to get Harper GC and Plappy GC in the top 10. That was the idea for Paris-Nice, to give these guys a go at GC, these young Aussie guys. But when Plappy just gets to the bottom of the climb, sees a gap and goes, well, fuck it, I'm going now. That's what you want. Yeah. And there was definitely no tactic that Plappy were going to launch him into this climb. It wasn't at all. And even then I was on the radio, I was listening to the radio and it was like, okay, this is good, Plappy, but just remember, you've got another 6-minute climb to the finish, you know, ride within yourself, you know, use Petrago, try and make it work. And then once you get over this climb, if you've got a gap, then go for it, you know. So all this is happening on the road. None of this is planned. This is all to do with just feeling the bike race. And I think the only way to beat these guys, these teams, these super teams, is to have these on the road feelings of like true bike racer to go, let's just go for it. You know, like, this is the moment. They, you know, they haven't thought about it. They, you know, we want to catch them out and this is what Plappy did. And then from there, that just built confidence. Like, there was some super, super hard rainy days and super filthy, you know, Paris-Nice, the technical descents. And I mean, I'm sure Plappy was completely on his limit a lot of the time when it came to this, but all that has shown is that he can do it. And it's really exciting to see. And the same with Chris Harper as well. Like, I think we all love seeing Aussies go well and these young guys who are normally working, especially like Chris working for someone else, goes, actually, you know, I think I can do it myself. And they put in the hard work and they go after it. So, yeah, it's definitely not planned. like a lot of people think it is.
I mean, yeah, like what I really love to see firstly is, like, you know, it's not often you see the lead of a race as significant as that, like, really change. You know, normally someone gets hold of it and the race is kind of locked down. These guys are in yellow. And it's hard for someone who's in the top 10 to get away and then take the jersey. It doesn't happen that often. It's quite rare. But what I really like as well is, like you said, it's like Heyman did his sort of work and his tactics once the race had evolved. So the rider basically took charge of going. And then it's like, okay, well, the best way to manage this is this, 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 and this. And I think that happens quite a lot with some of the best rides or results you ever get is like, okay, this is what's in front of us now, and this is what's going to happen. So do it like this. I think it's super interesting to see.
I think it's also nice and something that's really interesting hearing you say that, Durbo, someone that I would probably say those comments about you. It'd be nice to be Durbo, you know, to have an engine like that. It's interesting to see Durbo. He's got something pretty good under the hood there. For you to have that appreciation for Plappy gives me the idea of what kind of engine he has. And then, you know, when you say that, for a guy to come in this race and just sort of beat these teams to be able to be racers and evolve, they've got to have the engine these days. You know, it's just, you know, look, I'm only assuming from the outside, but we're talking about ridiculous level in the peloton now. And you've just got to be at that level to be able to evolve, to be able to have Heyman, to be able to use you guys, to have riders like that, to maneuver them around. There's longer the gone of, you know, the half-wit tactical guys, you know, like the things that I used to plead, you know, you get through the bunch, you know, if you're smart and all that stuff. I don't know if that really exists anymore, Derbs.
No. I mean, I also heard from Sam Bewley after Nick Schultz win in Catalonia. That's another tactical one that Tom, we might touch on quickly, but it was just that Sam had said Stevie has such a good racing brain, and that was not planned. You know, Schultz, he was obviously doing the lead out for Stevie, but for Stevie to see that it was a good moment to let that wheel go through the town, through the corners, through this, through that, was only going to set himself up for someone to, they were going to come up short for sure, because that's a long finishing straight. If Stevie had stayed on Schultz's wheel, they were probably going to get swamped, but Stevie's going, okay, well, I'll let Schultzy go, you know, give a little carrot for someone else to chase. Someone else will come and have to desperately get to him. They'll lead me out, and then if they get to Schultzy, then I'll come past them. You know, like, and in a moment, and you know how stressful that is in the last kilometer of a bike race, going full gas to make that decision, split second, is not something a director or a plan can do before a race. You just can't do it. You have to be, one, you have to have the legs to be in the position, but two, you have to have that mindset of going like, actually, no, this is not looking right. I need to do something to adjust. And, you know, it was really, I mean, we're all big fan of Schultzy and also Stevie, but it was really cool to see that.
Yeah, that was a great maneuver and well worth mentioning. You know, I think everybody watched that and thought that was a fantastic move. And again, like you said, improvised in the moment by Mitch's current favorite rider, Stevie Williams. Big fan. Lads, I'm going to finish off the communique in real UCI style with the fines. So I'm going to talk a little bit about fines. The UCI is, I've noticed in the last few races, started there another hard clampdown on UCI points for bidons thrown away. And we were just chatting amongst ourselves before about quite how, I guess, like a lot of UCI rules, it can be quite inconsistently the way that it's applied. So it's, I think, 25 UCI points to throw a bidon, which is, you know, 10 more points than winning a stage of a race, or, you know, 2.1 race. So it's significant fine. It costs the team a lot. And as a DS, we obviously tell riders, you know, don't throw bidons away. You've got waste zones. But a lot can happen in the race. A rider forgets, or it's unclear to the rider as to who they can throw it or where they can throw it to. And I mean, we'd go to DS meetings and they say things like, yep, you can throw bidons if you're on an uphill. So, okay, well, what's an uphill? Is it 1%? Is it 2%? Is it 3%? Can you define what an uphill is? Is it a KOM? You can throw a bidon to a soigneur or a member of the public, but you have to do it on the floor, etc., etc., etc. From my side, it seems pretty ridiculous. Durbo, how is it for, you know, as a rider in the bunch? I mean, you're trying to do the right thing, right? If your DS says to you, don't throw a bidon away, of course you're going to try not to do it because you don't want to lose 25 points, but it's going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, I think the hard thing about it is that UCI had a big Christmas party last year and they just want to go one bigger. I think they booked David Guetta this year and, you know, he's quite expensive and they don't know what to do. So they really need that. They really need that money for that Christmas party. It's really frustrating, man. 25 points is insane. I mean, just to get those points is so hard. As Tom said, you know, like talking, you know, 15 points for a 2.1. It's 25 is just such a gutting thing to happen. Look, and the hard thing for us is the dispute as well. Like, there is no dispute. It just comes off. And at the end of the day, and even if you were to say it wasn't me, or it bounced out of my bike, or like, oh, they've got the wrong number, they got the wrong guy, it's raining, they've got a rain jacket. Like, it's really, really difficult to make that. I don't really know what the look. I think from when I first turned pro to when I am now, the effect of the rubbish is so much better. Like, we literally jumped in the rubbish zones. I mean, it was terrible before, when I really think about where we used to just throw everything on the ground. You know, that was just what it was. That's what you did. So now that's much better. And look, the fines have probably helped that, but it really does probably need to be a bit more clear for the directors and for the teams to be able to educate the guys to go, look, this is clearly what the rule is. And I'm sure that it is there, but really just needs to be emphasize, like, this is what you can or cannot do, because these points and this money, like you said, Tom, like, the amount of money in fines is incredible. And actually now we are, as riders, we are paying for them, you know. Which has also made it another factor of, like, make sure you don't mess up, because at the end of the season all the fines go together and all the riders split them. So yeah, it's tricky.
All right, boys, so I'm going to be quiz master this week.
Oh, here we go.
It's a classics-themed quiz, but with a twist. First 5 questions on the classics. Next 4 questions are on each other.
Oh.
Right? And then the final question is a bonus question. So I'm going to start off with you, Durbo, with your questions. Are you ready?
Yep.
Right. Can you name a rider who has won the Tour de France and the E3 prize?
Geraint Thomas.
As easy as.
Correct.
There's only one.
Can you name one of the 6 riders who hold the record for the most Gent-Wevergem wins?
I know this.
Most Gent-Wevergem wins. Tom Boonen?
He is one of the 6. Correct. You could have had Cipollini, Sagan, Merckx, Van Looy, and Iname.
I just gotta go Merckx. If in doubt, just go Merckx.
Yeah.
I was actually gonna say Peter. Anyway, I'll let you go.
Best Australian finisher at Tour of Flanders.
Stuart O'Grady was 4th, I think.
Ooh. I'm going to give you 0.5 point because he was 3rd.
Ah, shit.
Well done, Derbs.
So, this one. In 1984, Sean Kelly rode the Tour of Flanders on Sunday, took a private jet down to the Basque Country, rode a 5-stage race, Tour of the Basque Country, took a private jet back, had a rest day, lazy, then he rode Roubaix. His worst position in a race, okay, over that period, was it A, 8th, B, 6th, or C,
12th? I have no idea. I'm going to go 6th.
Unlucky. It was 8th. He was 8th on the first stage of Basque Country. Then he was 2nd. Then he won 3 stages. He was 2nd at Flanders. Then he did all that. And then he won Roubaix. And then, just for good measure, he went to the Tour of Spain, which used to be in May. And his lowest placing on a stage there was 7th for the entire race.
That is absolutely...
Oh, and he won Milan San Remo. Which company made the first set of carbon wheels to win Roubaix?
Zip.
Correct.
Oh, well done, Derbs.
Now you're on to the Mitch Docker questions. You guys know each other well. You spent a lot of time together. The midweek race, the Skelde Pries, an amazing race which a lot of riders love. How many times did Mitch Docker ride it?
I know that now.
No shit.
I didn't know that a couple of days ago. I had no idea. I had to look it up.
I would say 5.
Oh.
Well out.
Mitch. Did I ride 5?
So you never ridden
it. We never rode it with Green Edge.
Yeah, but I thought you might have done it with like 2 times at least with Skill, or 3, and then you would have done it with EF.
One time,
ready once.
Once. Okay.
2018.
My bad.
What was Mitch's best placing in a classic?
Top 10. What was it? Were you 5th in Gent-Wevergem, Mitch?
Oh, mate, did you even listen to anything? Did you listen to anything Mitch said the whole time you lived together in Belgium? Or did you just ignore him with your headphones on? Go on, Durbo. You're close.
Mate, you're very close to...
You're very close.
You're close to the race.
Get where we're going. 4th?
1.
Ooh.
6th. I'm going to give you 0.5 point for...
Yeah, because at least it was lower than higher. Well done, Durbo.
Yeah, well, I listened to the Tom Boonen podcast and I was running that. I just couldn't remember what you said. You ran.
How many times did Mitch ride Roubaix?
Mitch Road, Roubaix, 12 times.
Oh, close.
11.
Okay.
Last question on Mitch. What color overshoes did he wear in 2014?
You should know this.
2014 Roubaix.
Massive.
Oh, you wore those filthy green ones,
what
didn't you?
Color overshoes?
What company was it sponsored by?
Bontrager.
They were the North Wave.
North Wave, mate. North Wave. Remember those socks?
Red.
Yeah, they were pretty
red and
awful.
Yellow socks. Red,
yeah, okay.
Steve-O hated them. That's why I wore them.
Right, so bonus question. There's triple points for this. If you can guess what I'm thinking, who is currently the most stylish professional rider, as in looks the best on their bike?
Oh, Vanderpoel.
Nah, incorrect. It's Dylan Van Baal. Sorry.
Come on.
Nah, that's what the answer is. It's written down here. Right, Mitch.
All right, hit me with it.
Paris-Roubaix, slowest ever edition. Was the average speed A, 19.9 kilometers an hour, B, 22.8, or C, 25.6?
19.
Incorrect. It is 22.8.
Damn it.
Who is Australia's best ever finisher in Gent-Wevergem?
Oh, I know this.
How do you know this? Oh, I should have done Matthews.
Incorrect. It's Hank Vogel's second.
Oh, damn it.
I actually was going to go Gossie. I think
right.
Gossie was still third on, one time.
Still on zero, mate. Still haven't got off the mark. How many times did Greg Van Avermaet win Flanders?
Trick question. He didn't win Flanders.
Well done, oh, no, Mitch. You got the trick either. Question. What is the name of the penultimate sector at Roubaix? So the one before the fake one.
Ham.
Correct.
Yes. One of the only sectors I know.
What is the best finish by a Canadian rider at Paris-Roubaix?
Oh, it's old mate. Couple of years ago. Oh, isn't it Bauer?
Correct. Second. So, Durbo questions. How many pro wins has Durbo got?
Including teams wins, like teams time trials and stuff.
I believe this is individual wins.
Individual wins.
It's not including those.
And yeah. Are national champs included?
Yes, I think so.
All right, all right. Jesus, he's got a few, hasn't he?
Yes, actually.
A couple... Geez, you won all those races too, Sarth and all that stuff. I'm going to just take a stab, too long to count. 10?
Incorrect. Durbo, I've got 13. Oh. Is that right?
Yeah.
So Durbo has only been in one team for his entire professional career. Mm. How many names has that team had?
Okay, quickly. Green Edge, Orica Green Edge, Bike Exchange. Oh, now I'm out of the team, so I can't remember. Well, Jake Alula, Mitchelton, that's five. How many years have you been pro for? 13 years.
Forever.
I'm going to say two more, seven names.
It's six.
Oh, it's close.
That wasn't bad, mate. You did well. Easy one for you because you were there. Which year did Durbo ride his first Roubaix? When was he nervous on the bus wrapping himself in sellotape and all this stuff?
Oh, 2013 it must have been.
Correct.
Nice.
What is Durbo's best result at the Tour of Flanders?
Oh, 16th?
Close. 12th.
Oh, 12th?
So Mitch, you currently sit...
2017.
Mitch, you currently sit on four and Durbo got six. So your bonus question, but let's say 3 points to win it. In cricket, who is the best test team captain in the world currently?
Team captain? Oh, it's not old, mate.
You have to say it if you want to win the competition. It's 3 points, and you have to say the best test team captain in the world is?
It's not worth it.
It's your call.
It must have currently.
Come on, just say it.
I can't even remember his name.
Just fucking say it, mate. Come on.
What's his name?
You're going to lose the competition.
I've just had a mental blank. That's how good.
The best Test team captain in the world is Ben Stokes. Come on.
Oh, God. I was Stokesy. Well done, mate. That was a very good question. I was trying to think of old mate, Root. I'm like, Root is not the captain anymore. And I'm like, oh, I couldn't think of Stokesy.
Ah, you missed that. It's a shame. I've been working hard on getting you to say that for basically the whole competition.
Very, there you go. very right. Good quiz, mate. Probably one good of the most entertaining quizzes. Boys, it's been a pleasure. It's been a long one, but a very fun communique. Thanks very much. Southam.
Nice one.
Derbs.
Thanks, mate. Cheers.
See you, fellas.
That iconic music in this episode was composed by none other than the legend, Pete Shelley. Cheers, mate.